Garden State Debate, where the talk is real. Garden State Debate, no joke, no frills. Garden State Debate, it's the talk of the town. Garden State Debate, for people all around, yeah. Garden State Debate,
Garden State Debate,
Garden State Debate.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Garden State Debate, video cast and podcast season two. I'm Ryan, and today we have a special organization and guest with us today from Winona's House, which is a child advocacy center located in Essex County, actually in Newark, New Jersey. They're a 501c3 organization. And, you know, we spoke before the recording of this show a couple of times and kind of thought this would be an interesting to do a multi-part series to this discussion. There's so much that goes into this kind of holistic approach, which we'll get into. So we're going to try to break this up. Today's discussion, we hope to get into a broad overview and maybe some dynamics of child advocacy, Winona's House, the history, how can people help, and things like that. And we can segue, hopefully, in the future into certain other topics that stem from this discussion. But just a little background on before I introduce our guests here. Winona's House, they've served approximately 800,000 residents and over 600 abused or neglected children a year. And they'll correct me if I'm wrong if that number has gone up. But a truly amazing organization with such a positive outreach and impact to our society here in our communities in New Jersey, child advocacy centers in general, and especially Winona's House. And they're at the center of so many different things like I had mentioned. I'm really looking forward to the discussion today, so I don't wanna really waste any more time here. We have Gail Britton, who's the board president of Winona's House with us, and Dominic Prophet is the chief executive officer. So welcome to the show. Thank you guys for making the time to come on.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. How are you doing? How are you guys doing today? Good?
Well, I'll go with Gail first.
So far, so good. I'm healthy, and that's a positive thing, and my family's healthy. And I'm happy to talk about families that are in the process of becoming healthy at Winona's House.
And I'm doing well as well, Ryan. And I echo Gail's sentiment. We're blessed to be here today. We've had a rough past year with the pandemic. And it's great to see many of our loved ones continuing to be healthy, but we've also seen many loved ones lost because of the pandemic. And we're blessed to be part of the support to make sure that we get out of this.
Excellent. Thank you both. Again, we really appreciate it. I think we're gonna learn a lot. In general, as we were speaking before the show, I think a lot has occurred over the last year in a lot of different ways that have impacted, society in general, and I'm interested to hear how it's impacted child advocacy centers and Winona's House. But maybe we can start, if you don't mind, by just kind of going over the background of how Winona's House became to be, like its origins, and also a little bit about child advocacy, then maybe we can segue into, the different dynamics that go into the approach that Winona's House takes.
Well, thank you, Ryan. I want to see whether or not Gail would like to take a little bit about the history, and I will definitely segue into some of the advocacy work that we're doing.
Sure. So Winona's House was started by a woman by the name of Jenny Brown, who was friends with Senator Lipman. And Jenny Brown was working in the child advocacy arena. And I remember her telling the story at a fundraiser where she said she went to see what we did when we spoke to child victims. And we had this one little doll in this ugly little room that we brought children into and then asked them to talk about, you know, what was a horrific, traumatizing experience. So she went to the bedside of Senator Lippman, who was ill at the time, and said, we need money to really have a center where we can really serve the children of Essex County. And Senator Lippman, from her sick bed, got the state to provide us with $1 million to get started. So it, you know, it didn't come all at you know, like a bag full of money, you know, how things happen. But that's what those two women working together were able to accomplish. And neither one of them, neither Jenny Brown nor Senator Lippman, you know, when you talk about, you know, pioneers, you talk about, you know, women that have carved out a legacy in New Jersey, it's not complete unless you speak about both of them.
Yeah. That's amazing. And just to put it in perspective, from you might have mentioned it, we're talking in the 90s, is that?
I want to say yes, probably in the late 90s. Late 90s, early 2000s, because we've been in existence, we're in our 21st year. So yeah.
95 was when I think a lot of the conversation about a child advocacy center and the model being brought to New Jersey. And when it came down to around 96, 97, when stakeholders were being brought together, steering committees were being formed, and support was really being galvanized for this type of movement in New Jersey.
And there was actually a team of people, Nancy Erica Smith being one of them, that went across the country looking for models that we could replicate here. And they found the best model, I believe it was in Houston, Texas.
Yes.
And they took that model, and that's how we, you know, that formed the bones of Winona's House. And that model, and we are presently the only child advocacy center in the state that has that model. And it really provides an umbrella approach so that it's child-centered. We focus on healing the child and not re-traumatizing the child. So they come to a child-friendly environment, and every element that's involved in the healing and the prosecution is under one roof. We center the child. So Dominic can tell you all of the agencies that are located there. As when the child or their family come back for treatment, they come back to Winona's House. Everything happens at our center.
Yeah. So Ryan, like Gail said, we are the only fully co-located center in the state of New Jersey. What that means is that at the center, is a 36,000 square foot center. We have the Essex County Prosecutor's Office represented. We have the Department of Child and Children and Families represented. We have the RDTC, which stands for Regional Diagnostic Treatment Center. It is the New York Beth Israel RDTC, and that they are co-located here at the center. And of course, you have our advocates here under Winona's House at the center. It is a fully co-located center that speaks true to the gold standard of the model, where all partners are at the center, where they can speak to each other, react immediately. And when it comes down to preparing to welcome and serve children who have been victimized in the county of Essex, we are all there speaking to each other, coordinating our efforts in this child first approach.
Got it, that's helpful. So you have a lot of in-house kind of holistic
mm-hmm.
people that are involved from various disciplinaries and
right.
And when you stop and think about it, Ryan, when you ask a family that's going through trauma to go scurrying around, you know, first they have to go to the police department, and then, you know, the police department might send them to a hospital for an examination, and then they might send them to the prosecutor's office. And this is one, that's one side is just the legal approach to it and the prosecutorial approach to it. And then, you know, what about healing, right? So this really focuses on, you know, yeah, we want to prosecute, you know, we want to make certain that we are getting at the person, the perpetrator, but we don't want to forget about the child in all of this and how that child heals, because people, children who hurt, turn around and inflict hurt later on. So the healing is critical.
Right. Yeah. And it makes a difference for our community. When you have a space that looks at the person, looks at the family as a unit, it starts the true foundation of service delivery in this field. You can't create isolation when it comes down to understanding what type of trauma the child faced when the abuser did what he or she did. But when you start to allow a safe space, and it's visually safe, meaning when you come to the center, you first see that it speaks to children with the art, with the design. And then it speaks to those who are there, who are fully competent in regards to speaking to a child, understanding the dynamics of the abuse, how to speak to ensure that they understand that everyone here is there to help them. That type of approach ensures that the child will be prepared and be able to say, I'm ready to disclose what happened. Because oftentimes children are blamed and they're ashamed to disclose, so that either by the perpetrator or sometimes by family members. And then these types of incidents goes uncovered, and it just continues to build that cycle of abuse that we're trying to stop.
One of the things we discovered, because as you can imagine, and Dominic was speaking to this earlier today about how much you learn as you go forward. So certainly we have learned an awful lot during the pandemic, or what I see as two pandemics. Actually, we might be up to three at this point. You know, we had the pandemic of COVID and the pandemic of racism. And I think we also have a pandemic of denial. But one of the things that we learned early on was the importance of treating the family, that because the shame and the blame happens across the entire family unit, right? And oftentimes the perpetrator might be a member of the household, and that member might be contributing financially. So there is, it's not just denial, it's that no one wants to believe it, right? Because believing in it means that this person is going to be prosecuted. This person could potentially go to jail. And where are my resources coming from? And that is not a need that is limited to low income people. You know, you can have somebody that lives in, I'm making this up obviously, in Short Hills, and the perpetrator be the financial support of the family. You know, facing that is very, very, very difficult.
Yeah. So if I may add, Ryan, one of the things that the pandemic laid bare was the inequities that we have in our community, whether it be historical, like Gail said, racial inequities, inequities that we find in income, and inequities that we see in regards to how our system has perpetuated many of the racism and the biases that we're trying to eliminate. Those inequities are often shaped, at least in regards to the pandemic, by these socially determinant factors of health, where many, depending on the environment, depending on your ability to continue to have work, you find yourself being more vulnerable to COVID, which was has hit Black and Brown Latinx communities the hardest. So these types of inequities we really saw that firsthand at Winona's house, when you had families who oftentimes lost their job. Many of our children were asked to be, to work, to go to school remotely. Many parents were working remotely if they had work during the height of the pandemic. So when we at the center needed to shift to engage families who weren't seeing as much because reporting had decreased, many reports were, mostly reports are done by teachers, mostly reports are done by doctors. Many reports are done by these mandated reporters. When you're in isolation, you don't have those avenues available. And what we realized is that many of the reporting went down, but the abuse was going up. And the avenues for reporting were not available for our children until we started to really, at least at the center, our advocates started to engage our families more and more to see how they were doing. And we started to learn that there were, you know, a lot of stressors happening during the time of COVID, and abuse started to occur because it gave a lot of opportunity for perpetrators when children are now kept closer to those who are looking to abuse and take advantage of children.
And if I can just piggyback on the whole COVID and the disparities, you know, when the schools closed, many of our children, not only did we lose the reporting mechanisms that we depended on, our children also lost meals.
Yeah.
You know, because oftentimes, you know, breakfast is provided and lunch is provided, and those form the foundation of the nourishment that many children are receive, and they get it through the school. They were sent home and, you know, and told to use their device so that they could log in. And many families don't have any devices or high-speed internet. So if I had a device, maybe my internet wasn't working. So all of these things, and then you think about the unemployment rate within Black and Brown communities, all of these things add to stressors, and stressors add to the type of abuse and neglect we often see. And add to that, that a lot of older children are then asked to, because schools also provide an element of childcare. So older children are then asked to look after younger siblings, you know, and that is a stressor. And oftentimes it's an opportunity for an older child to victimize younger children.
Yeah, absolutely. We're proud at Winona's House because the entire team responded as they should. Coming together all across disciplines, speak on how are we going to respond, getting the word from the medical providers, getting the word from the law enforcement, the prosecutors, getting the word and understanding approaches from the advocacy. And we were able to put a plan on how we're going to respond in this changing environment. And because of that, we were able to help families meet food insecurities that were came to reality when the pandemic hit their highest level. We were able to assist and get computers for children. We were able to support our families in regards to letting them know if something is going on, ways in which they can let us know. It was those types of approaches that made the difference, I believe, in getting many of our families who lost a lot, whether it be an income, whether it be social interaction and social engagement. They were able to make it through this very, very rough and continues to be rough, quite frankly, period, brought by COVID.
Now, that's great to hear, because that's my natural next question. We're talking about all of the complexities that the pandemic has brought and the inequities that it brought along with it. And you take that and you add it to a already delicate fragile, situation. And I was going to ask, like, how have you been able to adapt throughout that time? And you basically just answered that and laid it out, able to get fill those gaps that were previously filled by school reports and other things. I think that's very interesting. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about, I guess, maybe current state, what we're dealing with now. And you kind of alluded to it, but was there a huge uptick in, significant uptick in the amount of cases and calls that you were getting throughout the pandemic? And is that down or is that steady?
So we have to look at it by the evolution of our response during the pandemic. So if we go back when March of last year, when we first started to have the restrictions imposed on all communities throughout the state, and you had families going back into their, being asked to stay home. And also schools pivoting to a remote learning environment. And then many people losing their work. If you recall, prior to the COVID, the pandemic, the unemployment was at 15%. And then you saw an uptick that happened that almost reached 18%. And then you had, of course, the CARES Act that kind of balanced it out because it could have gone up to 20%. So when you have, when you see all of this, what's happening in the reporting is that, the avenues of reporting is not there. So you're going to see a decrease in the reporting. Families are now saying, and children are saying, I'm taking a position that I'm not sure if I'm safe. Everything's changing so rapidly. Mm-hmm. So the numbers went significantly down for us. There were a point where we were saying where normally we would get about 70 to 80, maybe 100 a month. We were seeing maybe about 20. And if that much.
So we're so that makes a lot of sense. You're talking about the connectivity that you previously had pre-pandemic was basically cut off and severed because of the kind of lockdown or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And now you're relying on like self-reporting, something I'm guessing on that.
Right.
So that makes the need maybe double or more. But the reporting was lower, so you had to kind of bridge that gap, which I'm
happy
about this.
And we actually,
you have to coax a child into reporting because of this shame, and oftentimes they've been threatened by the perpetrator, so they're frightened too. And what schools and doctors and other reporters have the ability to understand and appreciate are the signs of abuse and neglect.
Yes.
So when they get cut off from seeing children, when they get cut off from the opportunity to engage with them, the opportunity for children to gain the trust in that adult and share their experience, it's not there. So then what do you do?
And it's important for, I'm glad Gail brought up the signs of abuse, because when you look at the signs of abuse, I mean, some of them are, change in sleeping habits. You have individuals who may lose weight. Sometimes you might see unexplained injuries. Those are kinds of signs, or change in behavior, where they were very happy about a certain activity and all of a sudden it starts to change immediately. Mm-hmm. Those signs are things that those who are not aware of those dynamics may not see as, it may bother you, but they may not connect it to abuse. One of the things that happened during the pandemic, again, going back to the reporting, but it's also goes back to the education. We were also asked to do our work differently. Normally we would go out and have community conversations. But when during a pandemic, you're asked to isolate and people are asked to isolate, you're not having the same access to having those community conversations where families are starting to understand these dynamics. We used to do that almost every other week. We would have it a fair or a school. Our family advocates would go out and we would talk. And it is through those conversations that people start to say, you know what? I didn't know that a change in sleeping behavior may be a sign that a child is having, may have been abused or having some form of difficulty at home. It's when you get to understand that you ask those questions, like Gail said, you get to have those conversations that will create the safety for the child to disclose. During the pandemic, particularly, all of those things were really stripped away immediately. We did adapt, but again, it goes to the point of disclosure and reporting. So we did see a very a sharp decrease between March and April, and also May, where we saw a very quick decrease in the number of reporting that we normally see during the year.
Okay.
You know, the other thing that the center does and does really well, and I'm pivoting just slightly, is that we have forensic interviews. So we videotape specially trained people sit with the child so that they are allowing the child, they're in a child-friendly environment, you know, it's a special room with that allows us to tape the interview and the child discloses and they only have to disclose once. Because of the videotape, they don't have to say it again and again, because every time they say it, every single time they relive that trauma, they relive that experience, and it doesn't allow them to move forward and heal. So that's a very important part of what makes Winona's House the very special healing place that it is.
Yeah, and we use a method for those forensic video interviews. And it's a unique approach where they're interviewing, first of all, the approach is based on first responders who've come together to say, what's the best approach to ensure that the child feels safe and is not a repetitive type of interview that can add to the trauma. So it's done by a forensic video interviewer, specially trained to speak to children and not to provide leading questions, but to allow them to tell their story in their own way, in their own time, and also provides them the safety in using the proper words in regards to, you know, there's no shame in that's when they come to be interviewed, they understand that, you know, there may be other words that they've learned for certain parts of the body, but the interviewer allows them to speak in their own language in order to, you know, communicate what happened to them.
So everything you're talking about, I mean, it's all about not re-traumatizing the child, putting the child obviously at the core of it. But you also mentioned that there's family dynamics that go into it too. And
it's understanding those dynamics and understanding that the child has to be able to speak in their voice. And oftentimes when it's an interview, so when you are asking those questions, the question has to be one that is not leading them, but allowing them to tell their story in the fashion that they experienced it and remembered it.
That's very interesting. What other types of, I was just thinking in general, are the children that Winona's House support, are they on site? Like what percentage of time? I know every situation is different, but are they on site a lot? How can someone think about it? Or is it more of a interactive, how does the communication channels work throughout the process? And like maybe you could tell us a little bit about the length of time. Obviously that's going to change on each case as well, but how long might a child be in contact with Winona's House?
So if I may, Dominic, it may be helpful to share how we become connected to the child in the first place.
Yes, that would be great.
Yes, yeah. So we get our referrals in two main ways. One is through law enforcement, and the other is through the referrals that are made from the Department of Child Protection and Permanency. That's the CPS, or the Child Protective Services agency for the state. We have an Essex County area office that we work with intimately. So those are the two main referrals. There are referrals that can be made through a hotline, NJ abuse. But again, we get our referrals through those two main points. And it's after they do their first response, meaning they reach out to the family and they go in and meet with the child. There is a point where, given what they've heard and through their investigation, there is an interview that can be scheduled at our center. And that's the first contact for us at the center for the family. And it gives us an opportunity to us to coordinate with our team on how to welcome the family, to ensure they feel safe, to allow each partner to have the opportunity to do what they're mandated to do at the center, whether it's one of investigation of the crime that was committed, as well as the investigation on what's going on in totality at back home with the family. All of that happens in various stages as soon as that first step happens, when they're invited for that first meeting.
Okay. And the timeline, I think you asked about the timeline, but the, so timeline varies.
The timeline really varies. Every case has its own complexity. There are certain cases that may warrant a little bit more, but all of this, and which is important, all of this is based on evidence on how each component needs that. For example, depending on the child's developmental age, there are certain protocols where you will have an interview that may not be just one particular sitting. There may be interviews that may last a little longer. There are a lot of components that come into how long certain parts of the process will take. And that's the great part of our center, is tailored to the specificity of the case that is brought to bear. For example, we've had a case where there was a family where the mom was in a domestic violence situation, and there was an attack on her in front of the children, and the mother and the children at during the incident was trying to protect the mom, so they were witness of this incident, and this is something that was actually publicized when it did happen in the newspaper, and the mother subsequently did not survive the wounds that she had been taken on while the batterer had attacked her. The law enforcement called Winona's House to help respond. That particular response for us took the entire day. Because there were so many complexities of coordination that needed to happen immediately in order to make sure that we minimize the level of any trauma, first of all, that will occur by just moving children from that incident into a new environment, quite frankly, in a matter of seconds. So this is something that it took a lot of coordination and took the entire day for us to really support the family, where other incidents, it might be a little shorter response.
Right. No, I think that's a key point that you brought up, and you've mentioned it previously too, in terms of how quickly you're able to be in connection with the child is very critical to the for the development.
The model allows us to react very quickly. That's why we often see the most serious cases, because all the professionals necessary for this response is co-located at the center. We're able to speak to each other very quickly, convene a meeting to discuss the response, the approach, and certain aspects of the case. We get intelligence or information from those who are experts in child development, where some law enforcement may not have that level of expertise. So they have that support. Okay, what do you think, given these particular facts for this particular case, what's the best approach?
And as you can probably, as your listeners can probably well imagine, listening to this level of trauma and abuse as a family advocate, you know, as a social worker, as a therapist, is, I struggle for a word. You know, it's horrific. You know, it leaves the person working in the space oftentimes feeling very depleted. And because of that, we developed a quiet space within Winona's House to allow people to go and sit, you know, and just, you know, take some deep breaths and recenter themselves before going back at it, because this is hard to hear. You know, oftentimes the board will hear about a case, and we do it very purposefully so that we can connect the Board of Trustees to the work, right? So that they understand why the need for donations is what it is, why the need for their involvement is what it is. But it's hard to hear. It's hard to listen to. It's hard to imagine that within our society, this is going on. And to Dominic's point, oftentimes it's happening right alongside domestic violence, you know? And it's just, you know, when you try and wrap your head around a child, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to imagine, you know, how they might, how do they go on? You know, how do they move forward? And that's what we're there for. We're there to let the families know that, you know, they can move forward, you know, that there's light at the end of this tunnel. And the tunnel may seem very dark, and it is right now, and the light's very far away, but with each step, and we walk with them. And oftentimes we'll think that, you know, we are completed with a family, and then, yeah, they'll come back. And it just goes to say that this leaves such an indelible imprint, yeah, on the family and the child, that it's hard. You just can't erase it. You know, you help them to heal, and you hope the healing, you know, you hope that scab that forms finds, you know, beautiful new skin underneath, but it doesn't always happen in one swoop.
Yeah. And just to say that we never really close a case. We, even after some of our partners may close their particular case, our advocates continue to reach out to just make sure periodically to see how they're doing. That was really the impetus for our Family Advocate Volunteer Initiative, which we started about 3 years ago with the support of the Healthcare Foundation. They basically, our FAVIs are community volunteers that we train to assist and support our families who, quite frankly, after they have, you know, gone through the triage and they've received their initial support from the family, from our family advocates, they reach out to families that, you know, came through our center and say, you know, how you're doing. And we've, through that process, we've learned some families hit some rough economic times. They may be healing in the aftermath of the abuse, but, you know, life continues. And there are other factors that really can impede the progress of the healing. So it's through the FAVI program that we're able to say, you know what, let me help you to connect with other community-based organizations. So we stay with them, and like Gail say, they stay with us because we become the beacon of light when things get tough.
Oh, that's it. That's great to hear. And Gail's comments also kind of brought up a thought that I had, which was basically, you obviously have a lot of strong individuals who are working at Winona's House right now. When you were speaking about the just hearing and the day-to-day of hearing what's going on in the communities and the cases in the quiet room and all that. So do employees have resources themselves to, yes. I mean, I would say, you know, one would be to be so effective and to be so involved in such a, you know, important process. I would think that.
Yeah. I'd like to love to answer that. We are very proud. One of the things that we've done over time, not only are we reacting and but we're looking at how can we improve our center. That has been one of the key tenets for us last three or four, quite frankly, 5 years. We've wanted to say, well, what can we do to continually improve? The Serenity Room, what that Gail mentioned, is one improvement. The other improvement is that we've hired a therapist to be part of our team, not for necessarily our families, but for our team. Our team can go to her and just, if there's something that they want to talk about, they're able to have that conversation with it. So they're having that therapeutic support internally. It is a model that I hope other nonprofits who do the work, similar work that we do, will catch on. But I think we were very innovative in creating or starting to create a model that incorporates the wellness of those service providers, as well as those who need support and services. So those two in that equation will lead to better outcomes for our families and children.
Right, no, that's great to hear. So it's like it comes full circle in terms of a support system that you have. You know, to me, that's kind of what it sounds like from an employee perspective. And then through obviously the goal of the advocacy center in terms of taking care of what your mission is. Mm-hmm. But I know we could probably go on and we will in further discussions and we could probably go on a lot. I think it's very interesting to hear about all of this stuff. It's so important to hear about all this stuff. A lot of people don't want to talk about this stuff, but I think that people need to hear about it. And that's, you know, as I sit here and I'm listening and I'm listening to you guys and getting, you know, people, other listeners and viewers starting to probably wrap their heads around that may not have been involved directly with child advocacy centers and the education that goes along with that. I think it's incredibly helpful what you guys do on a day-to-day basis and then also taking the time out to do something like this to get the message out there. So I really appreciate, and I hope that we can get into more topics in the future, like what you were saying, like early signs and things like that. And yeah. Maybe we could also branch out into, you know, from what I understand, there's an advocacy center in each county in New Jersey. Maybe they're not all Winona's House modeled, and maybe we could, there's probably a whole, podcast or whatever you want to call it to be had on that as well. Yeah. But I hope that, it's great to hear about what you're doing. It's people probably feel all these different things hearing about the issues. But I would think that a lot of people want to help. So how can people help Winona's House? How can they support Winona's House and or anything else that you can add? And then we can go into maybe closing out with where we can find you, social media, website. I mean, I'll send that stuff out as well, but let's start with how can people support Winona's House?
So obviously donations are very helpful. Volunteerism is very helpful. We're very proud of a resource room we have. And one of the things that we have found in short supply, you know, so we take new clothing, we take gently used clothing, shoes, diapers, diaper wipes, baby food. But the other thing that we have needed, and I would believe that people who have school-aged children who've been home relate to, are snacks. Yeah. If anybody who's had a child home knows that when they're home, they're eating more. So imagine, you know, what that's like if you are already strapped, right? So snacks are something that, you know, our resource center, you know, as soon as they come in, they go right back out again. So we need, you know, food and cereal and things like that. But we could also use snacks. And I hear someone's head already saying, snacks, don't they need basic food? We need that too. But yeah, these kids, just like your kids, want a bag of chips. They want a bag of cookies. They want a juice drink or whatever. So let's you know, suspend judgment and say, these children are like my children. They need the same things my children need. And from the bottom of my heart, I thank you. And I'll let Dominic give you the website and the address where, or the phone number where they might call so that we could accept a donation.
Yeah. So our website is www.winonashouse.org. We have a Facebook page. We also have a Twitter page. So please connect us on Twitter and Facebook. You could just put Winona's House and it'll pop up. And our number here is, our general number is 973-753-1110. So those are the points, key points of you know, getting in contact with us. If you want to send a donation, please call first so that we can direct you to the right person in regards to sending a donation or sending an in-kind donation, which could be, like Gail said, snacks, clothing, et cetera, for the children and the families who need it.
Okay, thank you. Now, Gail, I'm glad you were straightforward with the snacks there and everything. People need to hopefully step up here who are able to. And, you know, if you have extra snacks laying around, or you can afford to purchase some and help out, I think that's, at the least, that's a good way someone could support. On top of obviously.
One final point, I'm sorry, Ryan, I get excited about donations, is that, you know, you might consider going online and doing your shopping, and then you can just have it shipped directly to Winona's house, and we don't have to worry about contact or mask or when you're going to come or whatever. So that's a way that I personally send my donations lately, unless I can get Dominic to come pick them up off my porch.
That's so funny. And Ryan, thank you. I'd like to say thank you as well for allowing us your platform to get the word out. I also look forward to having the conversation with the nuances on this really big, big topic of abuse and neglect. We have experts here that are top of their field at Winona's House. And I look forward to any opportunity for them to share their expertise with your audience. So look forward to continued conversation. This is truly a beginning, not an end. And our community needs you and people like you to assist them in getting this good information, this critical information, to make that difference in the life of a child and a family.
Thank you. No, I appreciate that. And I really like the idea of maybe having other guests coming on with you, and we can circle up and talk about how we can address some of those topics in future discussions. But I really do want to thank you guys for coming on and spreading the word about Winona's House, about child advocacy, about all the stuff that we're going to talk about in the future, and everything that you do and that the staff does. And everyone that's listening that will hopefully support their local advocacy centers or Winona's House. We thank them as well. So this is like you said, Dominic, you said a great, it's an ongoing discussion. So I think we'll be back soon. There's a lot of other topics that people are gonna probably find need to hear about and from an educational perspective and things like that. So thank you both. Thank you, Gail. Thank you, Dominic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'll talk to you soon. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Bye, Ryan. Bye-bye. Sure.
Garden State Debate, where the talk is real. Garden State Debate, no joke, no frills. Garden State Debate, it's the talk of the town. Garden State Debate, for people all around, yeah. Garden State Debate,
Garden State Debate,
Garden State Debate.